Leading up to the weekend when comedians are hosting a political rally in Washington, we thought it might be fun to look back a little bit, to look at a time and a place where much of this comedy originated. It happened not on the Comedy Channel, but in clubs. Small, walk in, pay a few dollars, sit down, listen to a comedian-sized clubs. Bob Ayers ran one called The Other Cafe. Now, this was back when Jay Leno and Robin Williams and Whoopi Goldberg were doing stand-up.
We didn't have liquor sales. It wasn't a bar scene. It was a small room, and every seat faced the stage, and people were there to listen.
So without saying the word that I'm talking about, the one that you know that I'm talking about, you can say it with a smile. You look good. How the f*** are you? Life's great. So you can say those words with joy and love.
Bob Ayers says it was a rich time for comedy because the performers and the people were close to each other, and it wasn't about meanness or tearing others down. It was all about the laugh. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced by American Public Media.
Coming up later in the program, the story of a young man who breaks into a boneyard in France, as well as more of your own ghost stories in the run-up to Halloween. But first, the other story, The Other Cafe. A few weeks ago, about 1,000 people gathered in a San Francisco theater for an unusual reunion. Back in the late 70s, when Bob Ayers opened his little comedy club called The Other Cafe, comedians like Robin Williams and Paula Poundstone and Dana Carvey came to work on their acts there. Now, the club's long been closed, but Bob wanted to bring the comedians back to the city, a sort of 30th reunion night.
It was not easy, but they came, and boy, did they come.
But he's here tonight, Mr. Dana Carvey.
Man, I feel, it's a while back there, so emotional. I met my wife at the other cafe. Yeah, yep, met her when she was 19. I raised her as one of my own. And I did that joke in 1979.
Hot night in San Francisco. It's rarely that hot. It was like 85 or 90 degrees outside, and the theater was hot. 1,000 seats, was a packed house, and all the old customers came, and it was the best night of my life.
Please welcome the incredible, you might have seen her at the other, doing her puppet shows with her feet, Paula Poundstone!
Well, first of all, okay, number one, I'm emceeing the next segment, which I don't know how well the guys from the other cafe remember how badly I always did that job.
Dana was extraordinary. Paula was extraordinary. Robin, who went on last, and he, you know, it started at 7:30. It was supposed to end at 11:30, which is already way too long. It didn't end till 1, and he got there at 7, so he was backstage hanging with the other comedians all night. You know, it was a benefit for KQED Public Media, which is the local PBS affiliate or whatever here. And so Robin walks out after so many hours, and I think his opening line was something like, well, the reason it's gone on so long tonight is because Ken Burns was filming it. And by the way, three babies have been born backstage since we started. And it was just perfect. It was just magic. It was just a great night.
Back in its day, the other cafe was on a bustling street in Haight-Ashbury. A bus line ran past the door. Two large picture windows framed the small stage, turning the comedy club into something of a fishbowl. And there were always lots of people walking by.
If something wasn't happening very well in the club, they could always turn and look out the window and comment on some weirdo driving by or walking by.
Or just standing there looking through.
And that certainly happened a lot. And the improvisational component of our club, I think, is what put us on the map. And when I say improvisation, I don't mean we set it up as improv, but the comedians could go out and step out of their material and play.
And this is something the comedians who played The Other Cafe also remember well. Dana Carvey was interviewed by KQED backstage at the reunion show.
One night, some local youths decided to harass the patrons at Maud, the lesbian bar. So I was in the middle of my second set, and I looked out into the street, and there was these 12, 13, 14-year-old boys and lesbian women in a giant melee, like a mini riot, fist flying. I just did running commentary. Oh, left. Oh, right. Oh, my
gone. She's going down. But again,
no, I don't know.
There was often little kids in the neighborhood who would bang on the window during a show, like Leno or Robin or Dana or, I mean, Seinfeld. We had them all. It would be packed, and people would be all up against the window watching the show from the outside. They couldn't really hear it, but they were watching. Invariably, you know, 13-year-old kids would bang on the window and then run down the street. And I remember often I would position myself. I'm a very fast runner. And so I would position myself out in front of the club waiting for these little kids to do that. And then they would do that, and I would tear out after them and eventually catch them. Again, I would not do this now. And I would chase them down the street. I'd eventually catch them because I was fast. And I would say, okay, who's your leader? And I would do the same kind of thing. Try to explain to them it's wrong what you're doing. These people paid money to watch this show, and something amazing is going on, and you're wrecking it. So stop it. It's wrong. And I would be in their face. But maybe 3 years ago, I was in the Hate, near the corner of my old club, and a young black man came up to me and he said, I remember you. You used to own the other cafe, right? And I go, yes. And he goes, well, you probably don't remember this, but you chased me down the street one day and you said some stuff to me, and you really got to me, and I really heard you, and I want you to know that you really helped me figure out that that was not an okay thing to be doing, and I just wanted you to know that. And man, was that cool to hear that.
You're listening to The Story. Bob Ayers encouraged the comedians at the other cafe to push the boundaries, experiment with new characters, play with the audience. Eventually, he instituted a new material night. The rules were strict. All new stuff, no matter how off the wall.
They could go up in a safe environment with their notes and just try stuff and know that if it didn't go over, it was okay, because the whole idea was we're trying new stuff and not everything's going to work.
How did you know if what you were seeing was actually new material, or what if somebody broke their rules?
That's not hard. When you're in a club every night of the week and you see the performers perform every night, you get to know their act. And sometimes we would even hear the hint of something from them and we would hit the horn.
You had what, a bicycle horn or an air horn?
Yeah, a bicycle
or something?
Horn, a big classic bicycle horn with a big black bulbous thing on the end. And it was just fun to have
it.
Yeah, exactly. Big honk. And, you know, and the audience loved it. The comedians were busted. Or sometimes the comedians would go, wait a minute, you haven't heard where I'm going with this. And so we would let them finish. And then, of course, it was still old material and we'd honk. It brought in people. It was fun for the audience. It was fun for the staff.
Yeah.
The comedians absolutely came up with new material. It was a reason to come up with new
material. Yeah, was there anything cool born on new material, Mike?
I think Church Lady came from that. I think Dana Carvey would say that our experimental attitude, and his, you know, he was sort of our favorite son. He was the guy that we, not discovered by any means, but he just felt at home there, and he lived in the Hate. He worked hard on that character of Church Lady there, and I think he still talks about it as the place where he just, you know, sort of worked it out.
The other cafe, I never would have got on Saturday Night Live without it. And the Church Lady just came from sort of, can't believe I'm doing this, but being on stage and looking very young for my age at the time. And I started just pretending that someone was in the back going, wow, we're a little too young to be in a club, aren't we? And that attitude got a laugh. So over the years, I developed the character at the other cafe. I mean, it was basically based on Church Ladies that I grew up with, that just that look, be like, wow. Apparently some of us come to church when it's convenient. We don't care too much about Jesus, do we?
But with the other cafe, like a lot of businesses, timing is everything. Bob Ayers' little club came on the scene just as the TV character Mork from Ork was topping the Nielsen ratings.
When Robin Williams got Mork and Mindy, and that became the overnight success, everything changed.
What, he never came back? Or?
Oh, he totally came back.
That's great.
That was the thing. He came back, and of course, it was a celebrity now. Suddenly, I could get press to come in and write about our little club because Robin Williams was there. Everybody wanted to come see this hot new thing, stand-up comedy, and everybody thought, okay, I can become an actor or I can get a sitcom if I become a comedian. And there was this explosion of reasons to be in comedy and reasons to present comedy because you could make money.
And so how many people were you putting into the other cafe in those years?
You know, our legal limit was 49. We had often 180 or more. And it was a natural, crazy tension. We would have one ear and eye out for the fire marshal every night. And, you know, there was no back door, no back exit, so it was really not right.
And what would happen on the night when Mork and Mindy was on television?
You know, I don't think there were VCRs then, maybe. I don't think so. And there was certainly no DVRs and barely cable. So we would set up a TV on a Thursday night with rabbit ears. Sounds like the 1940s right now. But we had a TV, and people would come in, have a drink, and watch TV. And they would watch Mork and Mindy.
Your suit's on backwards.
It is. Boy, do I feel like a clone.
You're not a priest. Who are you?
I am Mork from Mork. Nanu-nanu.
Mork?
Yes. You see, Mork is a planet.
Did you ever get him to come in on Mork and Mindy night?
No. In fact, I remember that, you know, he would show up when that was hot and everybody would yell out, Nanu, Nanu. And, you know, he would just open his mouth and people would roar. And he hated it. He hated it because he felt he wasn't earning his laugh.
Huh.
They just laugh or clap at everything. And there's no discernment on your material anymore. A good comedian like Robin, he wants to earn it.
Bringing all the comedians together again helped Bob Ayers remember the fun he'd had running the other cafe. But it also taught him for the first time just what it is the comedians live for, their search for the laugh, and we'll hear that story in just a moment. A bit later in the program, two farmers from Oklahoma talk about their plans to drive to the John Stewart rally in Washington. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. Dick Gordon, this is The Story. This weekend, thousands will descend on Washington, D.C. to watch two comedians, Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, among others, mount what will most likely be a very unusual political rally. Comedians these days are everywhere. They're on their own cable channel, they host talk shows. One, Al Franken, is now a U.S. Senator. My guest today is taking us back to a time when the best comedians still worked the club scene. Bob Ayers ran a place called The Other Cafe in the 70s and the 80s in San Francisco. Now, when comedy is good in a club, Bob says it's a powerful art form.
It's jazz at its heart. It's a good comedian, dabbles with his bass music, his bass material, but he or she goes into the audience and tickles and looks for things to play with.
I too, like so many of my brethren, have children. I have three kids, and I just showed them the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. I said, Mommy seems good, doesn't she? Because I think against that backdrop, I really shine.
And then it's back and forth. It's lovely. It's just lovely. And when it's good, it's magic. And you know, you could read all you want in the science magazines about the endorphins that are released with laughter. It's as healing a thing for our bodies as there is. Just physiologically what occurs in your body when you laugh. And when you laugh deeply, it's cathartic.
Bob Ayers was a Jewish kid from the San Fernando Valley in Los Angeles. Now, most of his friends were told they'd be doctors or lawyers when they grew up, but Bob grew up listening to something else.
We used to go out to dinner with my parents, my sister and I, to the local steakhouse, and invariably there would be a jazz singer or something in the background, and my dad would always wistfully look at that and say, boy, I'd love to buy this steakhouse and turn it into a jazz club. And I think I just heard that. So I think on some level it was embedded in me that you can actually buy a place and present, you know, performers in it. So I suspect that's where I got the idea.
But this wasn't the route that you were on. You were in college, right?
Right. I went to college, didn't know what I was going to take. I was on my father's payroll. My father had a company called Vicky Roberts, named after my sister Vicky and me, Robert. And it was a clothing manufacturing company with a lot of illegal aliens in a sweatshop. But it was very well air-conditioned, I might add, and he was great to his employees. But I used to work there every summer. And then I quit college unexpectedly when I was a junior. I was going to San Francisco State. Flew home to Los Angeles and surprised my parents one weekend and announced to them that I did not want to go to college anymore, but that I wanted the payments to continue.
Can I still have the money?
Can I still have the money? That check that has my name on it, Vicky Roberts, I'd like to keep getting those.
What did the folks have to say about that?
They were not happy. They were shocked. They were pissed. They were. They basically said, we'll think about it. And so I went back to San Francisco, and I think I knew they would say yes because they didn't say no very often. So my dad called me back a few days later and said, we've decided we'll keep you on for 6 months, but at the end of 6 months, that's it. You're done. You're on your own, and sorry. So 2 months later, I get the call, and the call is, it's over. This check you're getting on Friday is the last one. We just have talked about it. We think we're not helping you deal with reality. You know, we need you to realize what it's like to go out and make a living for yourself.
I can imagine this being a real blow to you, but I bet it was hard for them, too.
That's exactly what it was. I vividly remember in my apartment, which was, you know, half a block up from the corner of Haight and Ashbury, and I was sitting in my closet on the phone with my dad crying. And I was not crying because the checks were going to stop. I was crying because I knew how hard a call that was for my parents and my father to make. You know, they loved me, of course, and they took care of me, and they didn't want to disappoint me. But it was time for sort of a tough love decision. And they made it, And I just remember wanting to take care of him in that call, not so much worrying about myself.
Do you think it had the desired effect in sort of getting you to think, okay, maybe I do need to do something?
Well, it did. And then strangely, 2 months later, I called him and asked for $35,000 to buy a coffee house in the Haight, which, you know, so I immediately became more entrepreneurial and looked for more money more quickly, I guess.
When you made this pitch to your parents, you said, what, I want to open a club, or?
No. I said, there's a little coffee house in the neighborhood, and I go there for coffee every morning. And they did sort of folky music once or twice a week, and I just pitched it to my dad that I wanted to buy this place, and I just thought it was a good business opportunity. I don't know why I thought that. I was clueless. I was 20 or 21 years old. No idea what I was doing.
You didn't think it was going to be a folk club or a jazz club?
Oh,
or
heck no. I had no vision at all. I just thought, you know, they have customers every day. Of course it's making money. I'll make more money. I'll do better.
Bob Ayers didn't have a plan. He knew he needed performers. He went to check out a rock and roll band one night at a local bar, but it was the opening act that caught his attention.
There was a classic Jewish New York comedian who was opening, and of course no one was listening, no one was paying attention, and I thought he was really funny. During the break, after he was done, he was in the back, kind of in shell shock.
Nobody had laughed. Right?
No, and even listened, let alone didn't laugh. And so I went up to him, and I said, you know, I just want you to know, I thought you were hilarious. And he was, like, so appreciative to hear that anyone had listened, let alone liked it,
right. That
he just glommed on to me. And I told him why I was there, and I told him I had a little coffee house and a little stage, and he said, geez, would you ever like to have a comedy night there? I know he knew all the comedians in town at that time, which weren't very many, but there were some. And I said, well, yeah, that sounds great. So he put a show together for me on a Wednesday night, and I think on the second week, you know, I had Robin Williams and Dana Carvey, of course, pretty unknown, very unknown, really, and maybe 8 people in the audience. But what we did do is we paid the comedians. We gave them 80% of the door. And, you know, the door charge was maybe $1, $2. So, you know, when you have a big night, like 8 or 12 people, you know, you'd give Dana Carvey $2. And they were thrilled. They were thrilled because they were actually getting paid.
The club was called The Other Cafe, and pretty soon comedy was on the bill every night. San Francisco comedians like Paula Poundstone and Robin Williams were regulars on stage. You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. The Other Cafe was different from most comedy clubs. No hard alcohol, no mean-spirited jokes, no gay bashing. This was the hate. But the audience could get rowdy sometimes, especially when the performers were going out on a limb, and club owner Bob Ayers would step in quickly.
I had a unique approach to hecklers that I wouldn't dare do today. But then, if there was someone just making noise, I would go and sneak up behind them in the audience. I would go behind the heckler's head. He wouldn't know I was coming. And I would whisper in his ear. I'd say, if you say one more word, I'm going to tear your friggin' head off. And
are you a big guy?
No, I'm not big. But I was so incensed and so outraged that anyone would disturb my show or their show. I felt so entitled to stop it because it wasn't helping the show that I would do that. It was so shocking for the person who was a heckler to hear in his ear, out of nowhere, a whispering voice that his head is going to be torn off if he doesn't shut up, that I would say 90% of the time the person would become docile and just defeated.
If there was a comedian on stage who was bombing, and if the audience wasn't happy, are you sharing that pain standing at the back of the room?
Oh, yeah. And some of the greatest performances I've seen have been hated by the audience. But we thought what they were doing was hysterical. It's just the audience hadn't gone along for the ride. It was too weird. It was okay. Too out there. When it's really not going well, even for the staff and the and the comedians in the back, it's painful. It's like you're just wanting to get them off. And it's really hard on your body, and you know, you just have to get through it. And it's a bomb, and it's hard to recover from.
Because I'm thinking, if you're encouraging the comedians to do new material and experiment, there are going to be times when the audience is sitting there going, "Is this funny?" Right?
Well, a good comedian knows that in the first 90 seconds, he or she's got to say something to put the audience at ease, because there's a natural tendency for an audience to go, okay, am I going to like this person? Are they going to embarrass me? There is just inherently a nervous moment when a comedian comes on. You know, I'm thinking of one of my heroes in the comedy business, which is Steve Martin.
Yeah, I just got me a new car, though, so I'm pretty proud of it. And you know how it is when you get a new car. You can't wait to get out there and get it. It's a prestige car. 65 Greyhound bus. I put a lot of money into it, you know. Put a new dog.
I think in a book he tells the story that when he was starting out, he would put bologna in his shoes before he would go out on stage. And he would never tell anybody he had bologna in his shoes, but he knew that if he wasn't getting laughs or he wasn't feeling it, he could just think in that moment and know that he had bologna in his shoes, and the weird feeling and the hilariousness of that. It would put him in touch with his silliness, and from that silly place, he was funny. And I thought that was just beautifully right. And I've actually done it. I've gone out to parties with bologna in my shoes, and it's true. I encourage you to try it. It's, and don't tell anybody you've done it. But I guarantee, the whole night you'll feel different, of course, but you'll be different.
The Other Cafe had a good run, but they lost their lease and tried to open in a new location and ultimately folded. A couple of years ago, Bob Ayers got that itch again, the comedy itch, and decided to put together a reunion show gathering all the comedians from back in the day onto one stage for one night. When he got on stage, he had a couple of people to thank.
And I don't know if the spotlight, is the spotlight possible to go on? Are they on? If my parents might stand, make them stand, push them up.
I said to them, directly in front of 1,000 people, I said, Mom and Dad, I want you to really get it, that this amazing night that's about to unfold, these people here now, this would not be happening had you not given me that money, had you not supported me that way. And then I think I said, it was just a throwaway line, something to the effect of, and for you parents out there.
All of you parents out there, give your kids money, is what I'm... Give it to them.
And when I said that, it was a throwaway line, but there was this laugh that came out of the audience, like a big wave coming out of the ocean, and it washed over me. You know, you can't really see the audience when a spotlight's on you. It's just this black energy out there. And this, it felt like white light. It just felt like when you die and you see the light. It was like nothing I'd ever felt. I quickly finished what I had to say, and it was a nice, poignant moment. I came backstage, turned it over to the first comedian, and the show was off and running. But I came off stage, and Dana Carvey and a local wonderful comedian, political comedian, Will Durst, were right there, and they said, good job, you know, that was sweet. And I looked at them, and I said something like, guys, I get it. I get what it feels like to get a laugh. I never got it until tonight. As great as that evening was, and I got to connect with all the old comedians, the takeaway, the thing that was really, in a way, transformative, was I now know what it feels like to be a comedian and be getting laughs. I have no interest in becoming a comedian. I have no interest in getting on stage at all. But now it's in my bones. I know it, and it's.
It's like you didn't have to become an astronaut to go up in space, but now you know what it feels like.
Yeah, you got to be weightless for a few minutes, and now you know it, and you can call it up in your body. And I could see why it's addictive for these guys, that they wait all day to get on stage, because there's nothing in the day that's going to equate that to nirvana.
Mr. Other Cafe himself, the one and only Bob Ayers.
Bob Ayers joined me from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. And we have a link to the Other Cafe website at our website at thestory.org. You're listening.